Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 453rd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
Well done, James. I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. We are having a guest on today, and this guest is relatively new to the peer group. I think she started to get paid less than a year ago. but Jessica is going to lead us through one of her recent tools for practice. And Jess, could you just introduce yourself to the podcast listeners?
Well, first, this getting paid thing, that sounds exciting. When does that happen?
The check is in the mail.
Okay, I remember now.
One. It's somewhere.
So my name is Jess Kirkwood. I am a family doctor in Edmonton, Alberta, and I'm an assistant professor at the University of Alberta. That's very new to me. Actually, just in September was when I joined the faculty and I joined the peer team, though I have been blessed to work with Mike and Tina and Mike Kay and everybody for longer than that. It just became official in September. And then in terms of my clinical work, I am a family doctor at a place called the Boyle McCauley Health Center, which is an inner city multidisciplinary medical clinic.
Cool. So welcome to the podcast. And this, like Mike, you said, this is the first podcast we've had Jess on. And you're going to lead us through a topic that I am positive we have never covered.
Yeah, and know nothing about.
And so, know, like, exactly.
Yeah, that won't stop us from commenting.
Yeah.
I'm sure you can form strong opinions
about
it. But.
Yeah, well, that's how we start. We start with just a whiff of information and then form a strong opinion and go from there.
Excellent, as we all should.
So go ahead and let the audience know what we're actually talking about.
Yeah, so the first tool that I got to help work on with the peer team was on something called baby-led weaning. And so I'll probably start by just explaining what that is. Now, this is quite a foreign concept to you both, I imagine, as you, in your stage of life currently, are transitioning back to purees.
Yes.
That's what they in the nursing homes will be serving.
Well, the teeth don't work as well as they used to.
Right.
I have an awful story about that, but I won't go there just yet.
Good.
Okay, go ahead.
but baby-led weaning is a method that has become somewhat popular over the years for transitioning babies from either breast milk or formula feeding to solid foods. And so specifically, what is considered traditional weaning would be that babies are introduced to pablums or purees or softer textures via spoon feeding, and that gradually then you would increase the consistency of the food until babies are eating solids. But with baby-led weaning in particular, the goal is for babies to feed themselves and to do that by placing food in their mouths themselves. And you often start with more firmer textures than you would otherwise. And so for purists that believe in baby-led weaning or that follow it, there is no introduction of food to the baby's mouth by another person other than the baby. And so what this looks like is kind of strips of food or French fry-sized soft foods. So people will often steam vegetables or, even early on you have strips of meat and things like that, and babies will pick those up and they will pop them in their mouth. And there's a lot more to it than that, but that's kind of the really brief version of what baby-led weaning is. So people
that was a fast end to the podcast.
Yeah, no. but there is, believe it or not, and I would have never known this, there is actually evidence around some of this because, and again, as we talked about at the beginning, I was unaware that there was a, for lack of a better, a debate about this, but it's, but at least there's some evidence to guide us.
Well, and for myself, I have two kids. They are now 4 and 6, successfully weaned to solids in their lives. They're not nursing or on formula anymore. But it's been an interesting journey, I think, being a parent in this day and age where there is so much information and opinions and things on how to do things. I mean, I think for for the history of humankind, we survived by methods that worked. But then the internet came around and there was a lot of information in terms of, well, if you're doing it this way, you're doing it wrong. Or if you're doing it this way, you're doing it right. And that was as a mom, a new mom that tried to educate myself, I got very overwhelmed. But I did learn about baby-led weaning at one stage and thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then with anything, you can really delve into a deep world where people feel very strongly about certain things. And so it was kind of interesting then years later to find out there is actually evidence around this and for us to take a closer look at it.
And this debate was going on well before the internet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Baby-led weaning. Yes. I mean, I think I'm talking more about just
generally. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Information and opinions. And yeah, I think that parenting before there was so much information at our fingertips and things like
exactly,
that.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah,
probably
for sure.
A different experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But yes, baby-led weaning has been around for a long time. Was initially introduced by a person with the last name Rapley, I believe. We were trying to go back into the original origins of when it started, but that's kind of the I guess I would say baby-led weaning Bible was written by Rapley and is sort of your introduction to that. Now there's many, many, many other resources and things to find out about that. But that was sort of where I was first introduced to it and where people often refer you to look if you're interested in learning more about it or how you might do this with your children.
So Jess, the question that you guys kind of, and you could, there's so many different things you could look at, but the question you kind of posed was, what impact does baby-led weaning have on infant growth? And I think that would be an important outcome for patients or parents, rather. They don't want their children to have stunted growth or anything like that because of it. Iron intake, which is a marker of nutrition kind of thing, and then choking, the risk of it. So I think you kind of covered some great aspects of it. So what did you guys find?
Yeah, so it was interesting to see all the different outcomes that people looked at within the research. We did choose those three because we felt like they were the most clinically relevant as both so it was mums that worked on this together actually, which was kind of fun. But as mothers, we felt that these were things that we would care about parenting our children, but also if I was a physician and someone was asking me, or I am a physician, but was asking me, should I be doing this? I would want to know, okay, how's your baby going to grow? The iron intake is one that's something that's fairly easy to check on. And then choking is a big one because that's often a concern. Okay, you've got a baby putting a solid food in their mouth. Are they going to choke more often? And is there a risk to that? So what we ended up finding was that there was basically two RCTs on this topic. For me, doing a new tool, it was a bit confusing because when you first searched, there was actually, it seemed like many more RCTs, but it was actually just two RCTs, but one of them was published in many different places looking at different outcomes. So it had about five different publications off of the one trial that was done. And so I was like, there's so much evidence. And then like, why do they all have the same amount of children from the same place? And this,
and that's not unusual. And it's in it. For so many of these sorts of things that we do, there's so much investigative work that has to be done to go, why are we seeing all this, these different studies? And is this the same person or is it the same subjects in the study? And it can sometimes be just a, like I said, an investigative challenge. And I know, Mike, you've had that problem.
Yeah, so you can, and that's actually been researched in the SSRI world where some individual studies were published five different times from all using different authors. So So it is the investigation. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, was Tina on this one with you, Jess?
Yeah, she was. Yeah.
Yeah. So she is the Sherlock Holmes of the group, and she would not let that go. That's for sure.
No, she was all over it. I was like, I don't understand what's going on. And she's like, I do, Jessica. Figure it out. No. Much more kind than that. After she laughed at me, she said, yeah, no, these are actually all the same trial that's been published in many different ways with different authors. And so that's where I was confused. We initially found that RCT through a systematic review that only contained that one RCT within it. And then we found the second RCT separately. And so, yeah, to go into kind of what we found when we were looking at weight gain, it turned out that the babies that were in the baby-led weaning approach group, which did involve significantly more parental education and supports in both of the studies we looked at. So I think that is important that there were, there was kind of like, well, go off and feed your babies the normal way you would feed them with a spoon and a puree. Or if you were in the baby-led weaning group, there was many different times where you had interactions with health professionals in some way, be it a dietitian or nutritionist, or having more visits with your primary care provider. And then they also had a lot more information that was given to them. And even in one of the studies, we're given iron supplements, which I found a little confusing because why would we, if they were given complimentary packets of iron fortified cereal, if we were looking at iron, why would we only give one group that? That for me was a bit of a red flag. But in regards to weight gain and growth, they found that the babies that were in the baby-led weaning arm had about 0.7 kilograms less weight gain at 12 months than those in the traditional spoon feeding group. And so an important thing that we spent some time discussing is what does that even mean? What's 0.7 kilograms? And what is clinically significant? I think that looking at this data, you could look at it both ways. You could say, are those babies not growing as well? Or you could say, oh, great, childhood obesity is a major problem and we're finding a way to deal with that.
And so you gotta love that you can put it, you can spin that either way. And
it falls in that whole nutritional data kind of stuff where absolutely you can find evidence to support whatever you would like. And so that was where we really tried to remain neutral on this, because within the group that worked on it, we had all kinds of moms that had fed their babies in different ways. And I mean, luckily everybody's turned out okay. But we didn't have a strong opinion, and we want to make sure that when we're publishing tools that we're very neutral in that too. So we made sure to say, this is of unknown clinical significance. We don't know what 0.7 kilograms less in a group means. Certainly people that support baby-led weaning have very strong views that it is very beneficial. It's preventing childhood obesity. It's preventing bad relationships with food is one that is quite a strong seller for baby-led weaning because you're not overfeeding a baby with a spoon. If a baby decides when they're full or satiated, they can stop eating, and that's so healthy. I don't know. It's the baby. Those opinions are...
Their opinions, and they could be right, but... I can't imagine how difficult that would be to even study that. So, to do any of that. We will probably for the rest of time have just an opinion on it. And both of, either way is, you can't argue one way or the other because there's no evidence other than the things that you guys looked at.
At five or 6 months, it's hard to get a solid opinion. I know from my kids, once they started speaking, especially when they were in the no stage, that's when I asked them if they wanted their father to cover education, weddings, that kind of thing. And that was helpful for me. I got strong opinions about that.
Documented it all.
Absolutely recorded. But I don't know at 5 to 6 months if you're going to get the kind of in-depth analysis from these little kids as you might
know. Yeah, exactly.
Well, and I'm trying to look for it now. One of the studies did look at parental satisfaction, and then I'm just trying to remember if they looked at like babies' mood or something like that. I can't quite recall, but temperament. I think that sort of temperament. Thank you. I think
temperament used to be the big buzzword for little people.
Yes.
For these young little people. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
But Jess, they also said here that that one of the RCTs didn't just look at weight. They looked at the kilograms, but they also looked at fitting into a normal weight versus an underweight or an overweight category. And in that one, they found that the spoon feeding had more overweight, and the baby-led weaning had like 2% underweight.
Right.
I think that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about those findings is actually, too, how they defined underweight and overweight, because if you see, they defined underweight as two standard deviations below the mean, but overweight was more than one. And we were wondering why there was just a little bit of a difference. We were looking into the WHO charts and things like that, and we couldn't really figure that out because, I personally, as a physician, would be more concerned about an underweight baby at the age of 6-12 months than an overweight baby. I don't know how everybody else feels about that, but we're often more focused on poor weight gain or failing to thrive would be something that we would be a bit more concerned about than someone who was quote-unquote overweight, and how that is defined.
And a nice thing about it is that the vast majority of either approach had what they would consider normal weight. So even in the baby-led weaning, if we talked about that there were more underweight children, it was 2% more. Like 98% exactly. were normal weight and 2% were underweight. And in the spoon feeding group, again, 87% were normal weight with 13% being overweight. So, I think
majority was normal.
Yeah, yeah. And your comment about how you decide what is underweight and overweight and all that sort of stuff is really important. But at least those are the sort of numbers that we're talking about. And you look at it, and again, I can interpret that about as well as I can interpret a 0.7 kilogram difference in weight.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Exactly. Why do we call one standard deviation when you're high, that makes you overweight, but you have to be two standard deviations low before you're considered.
Yeah, who knows?
And is it just the numerical spread because you're at the top end and therefore you want I don't know. Yeah. I actually don't know, but I do find it interesting, and I know that if I have a strong opinion that baby-led weaning is harmful, I'm going to use words like they trend to be underweight, if anything.
Yeah.
Which is a gross overstatement of what this is.
Totally, for 2%, yeah.
Yeah, or the other way, or spoon-fed babies are, one in eight of them or so is overweight, and you can spin that, but it's only one standard deviation, and what does that pan out at age five, etc. Like, the big thing here is the differences are certainly not dramatic.
No, and I think that was potentially reassuring if somebody was really having a difficult time trying to decide what to do, is that at the end of the day, there isn't a massive difference either way.
Right, and then the stuff like their nutrition, like their...
Exactly.
Iron, hemoglobin, ferritin, there's no difference there, it seems like?
No, yeah, no difference with that. And there was other nutritional markers that they looked at within the studies too, but we kind of chose to focus on the iron because that's one that we tend to focus on in wee ones. And then also with those choking events, which for me would be concerning. I don't want to choose something if it's going to result in more choking events. That also had no significant difference between the two different groups.
And as you guys all well know, you can have. It's not exclusive to one type of approach to giving food. You get choking episodes.
Absolutely. And that's what I was just going to say. Yeah, choking can be defined. Is that gagging versus is this an event that requires back blows, resuscitation, that kind of thing. So, and that can be very difficult to interpret. As a parent, a baby might just have like a really good gag, but that moment when they're gagging on something is quite scary to you as a parent, as opposed to like an actual choking event that would require intervention or medical intervention. Yeah. So no difference between the two groups in those things too.
Wow. There is, the biggest difference here that you found was this tiny difference in weight in one of the two studies. And we should mention the size of these studies too, Jess. One was 206 kids and the other one was
206. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, somewhere between 200 and 300 for both the trials. Yeah.
And outcomes were measured at
12. The one looked at 12 and then the other looked at 12 and 24.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then the one that did extend that to the 24 months, there was no significant difference in BMI at 24 months either.
Interesting.
Yeah. So really, yeah. I mean, it shows that both seem to do okay on either way, at least from the outcomes that we're looking at. But obviously there are this sort of some limitations to all of this sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So certainly some of the limitations that we looked at, both of them were open label studies. As I had mentioned a bit earlier, we did find that the intervention group in both studies had additional training or contact with medical care or things like that. And so it just leads me to wonder that if we have one group that's kind of flying free versus another that's having really consistent interactions with healthcare, if there was something going wrong, would that impact an outcome, or would there be a space to intervene in some way there? And then also, I found it interesting that the one group in the RCT received the iron fortified cereal packets just in the baby led weaning group. That was something that I found interesting.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I'm trying to think whether, I mean, obviously in the study they're going to make sure that they do it properly, but I'm wondering, you know, is that something that's really even needed, other than, I mean, to recommend baby-led weaning, do you really think you need to have a person have four additional group training meetings and home visits?
Right.
I mean,
yeah, I think there's a lot of people that decide how they're going to feed their baby, and then they go off and do it, and they don't use this hand-holding quite to that degree. Yeah, I would be annoyed. I'd be like, oh, I've got another visit to go to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
in my practice, James, I generally only do 5 home visits.
Well, yeah, but you're a bad doctor.
I also wonder about the open label. And did they try to blindfold both baby and mom or dad?
No, they did. Interestingly enough, though, there were more choking episodes. Because of that. Yeah, no, that was in the one of the supplements I read.
Yeah, yeah. The supplements of the 5 publications.
Yeah, but I think it's important, because I think, you know, we know that common sense is often a superpower, but in these cases, I mean, a lot of it is just common sense, and there's no black and white about the way that this would work for individual children. Some are going to be more adept at eating doing a baby led weaning, and others won't. And it's all a trial and error process anyway. So, I mean, while it's great that there are probably, there are some useful, pieces of information to guide you on how to do this, I don't think any of these additional training things need to occur in the real world, or maybe I'm missing something.
No,
no, usually James, you are.
I am, but just not in this case.
No, I would agree. Babies have not gotten that much more complex over the last few years than we need this many interventions to figure out how to have them survive on food.
So what's the bottom? What was your sort of bottom line on all this? Because you know, we're probably not going to have any more definitive studies, and we probably don't even need them.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, for me, the bottom line would be that we can be reassured that both methods, or even a combination of the two, tends to be safe ways to introduce solid foods to your babies. Certainly, I do think that if you're going to try something like baby-led weaning, you would want to educate yourself a little bit in terms of when is it a safe age or developmental stage for a baby to introduce food into their own mouth. So you're not doing this at like 3 months when they can't even sit up or hold their head up. Mm-hmm. You're doing it more around the 6 month mark, where there's better coordination and things like that. But overall, I think we can just kind of be reassured that babies are going to grow, for the most part, barring any other unforeseen medical issues, to be healthy and strong on either method. And I wouldn't put too much weight in the 0.7 kilograms of weight gain on either side of it, whether it's this amazing thing that's going to combat obesity rates, or that babies are failing to thrive if they weigh 0.7 kilograms less. Yeah. I don't think I would swing either way.
And I'm sure there's sort of some common sense things that we could let people know about. I mean, you're obviously not going to create food that looks like something that could easily be choked on.
Yeah, we did include that in the tool as well. So yeah. Nuts, grapes, raw vegetables, raw apples, anything cut into like a coin or circular shape, those are all higher risk. They would not be recommended. and that you would continue either breast or formula feeding during this transition, because their babies don't all of a sudden hit this magic switch where all their nutrition comes from other foods. They still get a lot of really great benefits from breast milk or formula, and so to continue that during that time as well.
Yeah. No, that's so, just, go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, Jess, we should mention your co-authors, because we're coming to the end here, and so I just want to make sure we mentioned that this was a team effort.
So yes, this tool was a collaborative effort, and it was actually our Tina and I's co-authors that suggested this topic and got the ball rolling for it. And so that was Dr. Stephanie Liu, who's a family doctor here in Edmonton, and Aaron Manchuk is a pharmacist that works with Dr. Liu, and they work on a blog called The Life of Dr. Mom, which is an evidence-based blog. It's a health and medical mom blog designed for the modern parent who struggles with balancing family, work, and fun. And so, they try to help with that confusion, I think, that I kind of mentioned at the beginning, where you're this new parent and you're trying to look for information, and it is so challenging to find evidence-based everything. So that's something that Dr. Liu tries to do, and it was really great to work with her on this tool.
And I think it's quite clear that even our group that has, you know, is pretty competent at looking at evidence like this, every one of these tools of practice is a nuance that you had not realized. Like even just talking about the standard deviation things above and below the mean and all that sort of stuff. And so one of the, hopefully the useful things about the tools of practice is that we give that, we help people deal with some of the weirdness in the research or the either inconsistencies or so on. And like I said, we're just trying to give and we also give our own personal opinion on this when the evidence is not overwhelming one way or the other.
Absolutely. Right. Back when I was just a peer fan and I just would use you guys for resources, I found it super helpful to go to talks and listen about the different just intricacies with these studies and how things can, it's just fascinating how different data can be shifted and changed to depending on what your agenda is. And then now that I've been working on tools and I see how much work goes into one of these and how much you really get to know the evidence, it's fascinating. It's really cool. I'm happy I got this job.
Yeah, great. Yeah, and we love that you and people just like you can contribute to all of these things, because as we've talked about before, Mike, this is we know, we do like people to have the impression it's just Mike and I, but apparently there's a team behind it.
Yeah, apparently a massive one.
We're much shorter and not as good looking.
Well, that does go without saying.
Like little trolls.
Yeah.
Trolls working in the dark.
Yeah, living under a bridge. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but no, this is great stuff, because this is a topic that I'm sure not everyone has thought about, and probably most people didn't even realize there was evidence around it. But at least now you know the best available evidence, even though it's clearly limited for this topic. So hopefully it was a value. Mike, anything else you want to add?
No, that's good, James.
Yeah. So anything else, Jess?
No, I think I'm good. As being a mom that I actually used combinations of both methods, what I want to see is a trial looking at how fat do people's dogs get? Because I know when I had a dog and I was trying this and my daughter was flinging food everywhere, my dog got quite fat. So that's the next step, I think, is obesity in dogs.
Yeah, well, there's always, as with anything, there's always unintended consequences.
I guess it was less food that I was eating, so I'd rather have a fat dog.
Yeah, exactly. So given that we probably can't answer that direct question, I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Thank you for having me.